Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. In the first hour of the show today, we'll be talking with Thomas DeFrank. He's the Washington Bureau Chief of the New York Daily News. For 25 years, he was the White House correspondent for Newsweek and also served for 12 years as Deputy Chief of the magazine's Washington Bureau. He has been following Washington politics for quite a long time. In fact, going back to 1968, when he took his first presidential trip with Lyndon Johnson as an intern for Newsweek. He traveled extensively with Richard Nixon from 1970 until 1972, and was assigned to cover then-Vice President Gerald Ford in the fall of 73. A few months before Nixon resigned, our guest was reassigned to the White House, and he remained when Ford became president in August of 1974. In 1991, he and the then former president, Gerald Ford, began an unusual series of candid conversations during which Gerald Ford said what he really thought about politics and about politicians. The only catch was DeFrank couldn't publish any of it until after Ford's death. In this hour of our program today, we'll talk with Thomas DeFrank about the result of all of those conversations. It's a book that is titled Write It When I'm Gone, Remarkable Off-the-Record Conversations with Gerald R. Ford. Putnam is the publisher. It's out now in the bookstores, has been for a little while now. If you're interested in reading the book, you can seek it out. And here on the program, your questions are welcome, too. The number in Champaign-Urbana, here where we are, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line. That one's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. At any point here, if you're interested in joining the conversation, you can do that. The only thing we ask of callers is that people are just brief, and we ask that so that we can keep the program moving along. But, of course, anyone who is interested in joining in the conversation can do that. Mr. DeFrank, hello.
Good morning.
Thanks for talking with us.
Glad to be here.
I think the place to start is for me to ask you to tell the story of that encounter that you had with Mr. Ford in 1974 in Palm Springs.
It was April of 74, right after Easter, and I was a young reporter for Newsweek magazine. I'd been assigned to Ford. I'd been traveling with him for about 3 months, and my first son had just been born, and so I'd come off the trail to be with mother and child for about 10 days, and I was behind. And so when I finally was able to come out to Palm Springs, I called out and asked for an interview. I really didn't envision it as an interview, just a little bit of a catching up. And he was very gracious with his time with all of the regulars who traveled with him. There were six of us. And he said, sure. So I flew out to Palm Springs, went right to his office suite in the International House Hotel, and he had just come in from the golf course, and we just had a nice chat, and I took a few notes. Actually, I took a lot of notes, but it was just really chit-chat, and at the end, as I got up to leave, he said, put your notebook up, I want to show you something. His press secretary had left the room about 10 minutes before and hadn't come back, so it was one of those perfect moments that only happened very seldom in a career. No witnesses, just the two of us. And I think that emboldened Ford to ask me about something that was really on his mind. Bill Sapphire of the New York Times had written a column accusing Ford of being disloyal for some remarks he'd made to a reporter for the New Republic, talking about how a Ford administration might be different from a Nixon administration. And this drove Ford crazy, because accusing him of being disloyal to an old friend was a real hot button for him. He thought that they were old friends. They had been elected to Congress within 2 years of one another in the late 1940s. And he thought he'd been bending over backwards to be loyal to the man who named him to be vice president. And so to be accused of disloyalty drove him crazy. And he was really agitated, and he showed me a column, the column by Bill Sapphire that coincidentally I just read coming out to Palm Springs on the airplane. And he said to me, I really want to know what you think about this. And he was really pressing me for an opinion. Now, I don't think that's a very good idea. Usually I would never give advice to anyone I covered. But I don't often give an opinion on anything either. I just think it's not very not very wise, but he was really pressing me, and I was 28 years old, and he said, I want to know what you think. He said, I've been damn loyal to Dick Nixon. I want to know, why would they do this to me? He was very agitated, and I blurted out, well, you know, Mr. Vice President, I think it's pretty simple. People around Nixon know he's finished. He can't survive, and you're going to be the next president. And Ford blurted out without thinking, you're right. But when the pages of history are written, nobody can say I contributed to it. Well, this was a thunderbolt. He knew it, and I knew it. And like every politician from the dawn of civilization who has been caught saying something he wishes he hadn't, he tried to take it back. You didn't hear that. That was off the record. That's not what I meant, et cetera, et cetera. And I didn't say anything. And I think Vice President Ford inferred from my silence that I was going to use this. And all he should have inferred from my silence was that I was scared to death. Because I was 28 years old, I'd been told by my boss he's the next president, get close to him, learn about him, know who he is, know who his people are, and I will go to the White House with him. So I didn't say anything. And so he came around his desk, and he said to me, damn it, Tom, you're not leaving this room until we have an understanding. And the understanding was he didn't want me to use this, and he wanted me to promise him that he wouldn't. And I froze. I was really scared to death at this point, especially since he was very gently holding on to my tie. You know, this was a close encounter. He had really striking blue eyes, and I got a really good look at him. And so I froze. I was speechless, literally speechless. And it was Jerry Ford who came up with an idea to get us out of this bind. He said, write it when I'm dead. And I was so relieved. I didn't say, well, I ought to check with my editors. I didn't try to negotiate some way to use this information, which I, in retrospect, I know I should have, but I didn't. I just said, okay. He stuck his hand out. We shook hands. And for the next 16 years, we never mentioned it again. And in the next 32 years, we only discussed this encounter one time. And from the moment we shook hands, it was like it never happened. He walked me to the door. He talked about my wife. He talked about our new son. He did chit-chat. It's like it never occurred.
Now, I'm sure this is one of those stories that when other reporters hear it, they say something like, well, if that would have been me, I would have said, I'm sorry, Mr. Vice President, but you know the rules. Everything's on the record unless you start out by saying that it's not. And I'm sure that there would be reporters who would have claimed that they would never have let themselves be bowled over by the Vice President. Of course, you can say that not having been in that situation. Was there any time over the years when you really thought to yourself, gee, I wish that I had tried to be more assertive, would that just not really have been possible?
Oh, well, I don't think it would have been possible. But the short answer to your question is, yeah, absolutely, many times. I mean, I'm 62 now. I'm not 28. And I've been yelled at by other presidents and other vice presidents. And I've been fortunate enough to live long enough to be able to tell the story to my grandchildren, or at least I can when they get a little bit older. But I was 28 years old. I was scared to death. And I didn't have the perspective that I think I have now. I would like to think I know I should have tried to negotiate something, but I also believe there was no way you could sugarcoat that one. Mm-hmm. And I suspect there was no way he was going to let me do that. And then. So I just made a decision, and I stuck with it, and I kept my word, and I'm glad I kept my word, but I wish I had at least pushed the envelope a little bit.
And you did actually end up, the magazine ended up using part of that part where he said something like when
the pages of history the pages of history are written, nobody can say I contributed to it. That was me. I never told the magazine about this. But to try to assuage my guilt with my employer, after Ford became president, I used the second half of that clause, of that pregnant clause, if you will. But I did not use the you're right, which was obviously the explosive part of what he said. But I was struggling with my conscience to try to do the right thing for the magazine, and so that's what I did. And so in the magazine that appeared in August of 1974, the Monday after Ford became president, and he became president on Friday, August the 9th, 1974, readers can see that quote, but it's not the whole quote, obviously.
It was your idea. You approached Mr. Ford in 1991 or thereabouts, suggesting that you could have a series of conversations and it could be on essentially on the same terms.
That's right. It was some reporters say, "Well, how could you have allowed him to dictate these rules to you?" And I always say, well, it wasn't his idea, it was my idea. I'd heard over the years from other aides, just to give you an example. Let me back up just for a second. I thought that what Ford was saying about various things in retirement were not quite what he was really thinking about certain things, and in particular it was Ronald Reagan. I'd heard over the years after he left office that he was still angry at Reagan. And I would see Ford every year or two, for every 18 months, and I'd say, "You heard from Reagan, you talk much," and he'd say, "Yeah, we get along fine. He called me on my birthday. I saw him 6 months ago," and it was all very guarded. And I'd say, "Well, I keep hearing that you still haven't forgiven him for 1976. He says, "Well, that was a long time ago." He would duck me. But I kept hearing from aides and friends that he was still furious with Reagan. And so in 1991, I said, maybe there's a way to try to encourage him to be more candid about what he really thinks about people and places and momentous events in his career. And so I came up with this proposal. Now, obviously, in the back of my mind, you're quite right. In the back of my mind was, I remembered what happened in April of 74, and I said to myself, well, he has to have remembered that, and if he does remember that, he knows that I've kept my word on that one for 17 years so that my word would be good going forward. And I never said that to him, and he never said that to me. But about 3 days after I made this proposal, his chief of staff called me and said, "He's fine with it, and let's do it." So that's what happened.
You know, I think when I read about this and read some of the things that Mr. Ford had said, I was fascinated, as I'm sure that a lot of people were, and was thinking, this is the level of candor one would wish for in our political leaders. There are so many times, particularly, I'm sure, as a reporter, when you ask a politician something and what you get back is boilerplate, and you think to yourself, wouldn't it be great if this person would really tell me what they thought? On the other hand, I guess I also felt myself thinking that as far as Mr. Ford was concerned, with it embargoed essentially till he was dead, is that somehow for him there were no consequences. There was nothing, you know, since he would be gone, there was no cost to him to do it. And I wonder how it is that you in a sense weighed those two things. On the one hand, really getting what the guy said, thought, and that on the other hand, that he could essentially say whatever he wanted, and there would be no cost to him.
Well, I disagree with your premise up to a point. There is a cost to him, in the sense that he does not have the last word, because you can be sure now that this book is out, and he said things about Bill Clinton and Hillary Clinton and Ronald Reagan and other political contemporaries, you can be sure that the champions of those individuals are going to have plenty to say, if not to me, but to other reporters and to history. And I assumed at the time that would be the case. The history would not just say, "Oh, well, this is the last word, so we'll just leave it right there, and we'll engrave President Ford's comments from the grave in stone." That's not going to happen. That's why I think this is... I call this a new rough draft. I call the book a new rough draft of a momentous period in American political history, in the words of a fascinating guy right in the middle of it. But it's a new rough draft, just a draft. And I think historians, scholars will take President Ford's comments. They'll parse them. They'll assess them. They'll analyze them. They'll critique them. They'll ask other people, especially people he's had a couple of harsh things to say about, they'll be asked about it, their friends, their families, their experts, and so there'll be an ongoing dialogue. So I don't think that he gets off cost-free.
Our guest in this hour, Thomas DeFrank, is the Washington Bureau Chief of the New York Daily News. He was for 25 years the White House correspondent for Newsweek. He also served as Deputy Chief of the magazine's Washington Bureau for 12 years. He was first assigned by Newsweek to Vice President Ford in 73. That was during the final months of Watergate. Then he covered the Ford presidency from start to finish. And in 1991, began a series of conversations that ended up being 18 interviews over 16 years, during which Mr. Ford said a lot of things about what he felt about American politics and about his presidency and about people in American politics. And the only catch, as I said at the beginning, was that none of it could be published until Mr. Ford had died. And the result is this book that's titled Write It When I'm Gone. It's published by Putnam and is out now. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Well, certainly I want to go on here and give you a chance to talk about some of the things that Mr. Ford said. I'm sure that probably for many people, maybe most people, the one thing that Gerald Ford is remembered for is pardoning Richard Nixon. For that, I think people think negatively. Many people think negatively because of that. And certainly he must have known, certainly he knew when he made that decision that it would not go well with him and with his political future. At any point, did he voice any regrets that he had chosen that course?
No, none whatsoever. And I'm often asked. Are there any issues? Are there any instances where he was no more candid in private in these conversations than he was on the public record? And there are, this is the one where he was, where he says exactly in private what he said in public in hundreds of interviews over the years. He said he had no regrets. He said he did it to help his presidency and to help the country. He was convinced that he said this many times, he was convinced that the country would be just paralyzed. He did say to me, on the 20th anniversary of his becoming president, in an interview in Colorado, that he was convinced that Nixon would be indicted, Nixon would be sent to trial, would be convicted, and would be sent to jail, and would be in jail while appeals went on for years. And he, Ford, concluded that would paralyze the country and paralyze his presidency, and that's why he did it. So he never expressed any regrets to me in private. The one regret he did express was not about pardoning Nixon, but not pushing Nixon harder to find out what was really going on. He did say to me in 1991, I was with Nixon a few times alone, and I had the opportunity to say, Dick, we're old friends. I need to know. Do you know about this? Are you involved in this cover-up? And he said, I never did. And he said, in retrospect, I know I should have. And this is one area where I thought his explanation was very, very lame. When I pressed him on why he didn't, he said, well, you know, when we were together, Nixon would always preempt me. He'd say something like, well, you know, Jerry, and these are my words, not Nixon's, of course. He said, you know, Jerry, I'm too busy saving the world. I'm dealing with Mao Zedong and Zhou Enlai and the Chinese. I'm dealing with Leonid Brezhnev on arms control. I'm trying to bring peace to the Middle East. I spend all my time on foreign policy, and I just pay no attention whatsoever to domestic policy. And Ford said that was Nixon's way of saying to me, I'm not involved. As I said, I thought that was a fairly lame explanation. My theory, and it's just a theory, I think he didn't ask Nixon because he didn't want to know, because I think he suspected that Nixon was lying to him and would probably lie to him again, and he just didn't want to go down that road.
And he apparently, though, Mr. Ford thought that somehow that Nixon could have handled the problem of Watergate differently and could have avoided being forced out?
Well, he thinks that Nixon, there was something in Nixon's personality that just precluded him from ever admitting he'd done something wrong. Even when he knew he was wrong, he just couldn't bring himself to do it. And Ford always thought if Nixon had just thrown himself on the mercy of the American people and said, I made a dreadful mistake here, and I'm sorry about it, I've learned my lesson, and go on, that this is a forgiving country, we're very big into redemption, and he could have survived. But that he just didn't have it within his chemical makeup to do that.
We have a couple callers, so why don't we bring them into the conversation? We'll start with someone listening in Champaign County, here where we are, line one. Hello.
Hi. I was calling about a couple of other things, but on this note, it seems to me that he had legal advice fairly comparable to what Bush is getting now, that if the president does it, it's legal. Some kind of unitary executive early principle of that. Some of the same people are still around. I believe that was from Rehnquist, the late Rehnquist. But I actually wanted to ask you about a foreign policy issue, and then also about the run for the re-election with Cheney and Rumsfeld in tow. The first point is, do you remember contemporaneously, and was there much reflection on the situation in Southeast Asia, not Vietnam, but in Indonesia and Timor? Timor was a genocide that proportionally was worse than Cambodia. And Kissinger and Ford were in Indonesia and Jakarta 2 days before the invasion happened. They basically gave the green light to it. A lot of people from my end of the spectrum say that Ford was the best president because he didn't fight or start or fight any wars. He had to put one to bed in Vietnam, but he actually ignited, as I say, this very catastrophic invasion that still has repercussions to today and for those poor people in Timor. But so, do you remember anything contemporaneously as you were reporting? Was it an issue at the time?
It wasn't an issue that I recall at all at the time.
And did he reflect on it at all?
No, I didn't. We didn't talk a whole lot about policy, and that was not the purpose of the book. I didn't want to do a policy book, and I didn't want to do a classic biography. I just wanted to get him talking about himself, about his life, his reflections, the people around him, the people who work with him, and as I say in the prologue to the book, I didn't want this to be a policy piece. A book, so we didn't talk about that very much.
Well, then if I may just go right on to the next question, which is about the loss of the re-election and the bumping of Rockefeller, who I guess Ford would have preferred, but Cheney, I guess, I forget what his, he was chief of staff, Rumsfeld had a high position as well. The re-election campaign was mainly staffed over by Cheney, and the decision to not go with the more "quote unquote" liberal Rockefeller came out of Cheney's.
Well, the Rockefeller and Cheney engineered the coup that replaced Rockefeller. Now,
Rockefeller and Rumsfeld, you mean?
Excuse me, exactly right. Cheney and Rumsfeld engineered the coup that replaced Rockefeller. Now, Rumsfeld and Cheney wanted Rockefeller to be replaced with Rumsfeld, but that didn't happen. Ford replaced Rockefeller with Bob Dole. But Ford said to me that was his greatest political regret, that he did not stand up to the right wing in his party and say, Nelson Rockefeller is a good guy and I'm going to run with him and I'm going to win. And ironically, I think if he had kept Rockefeller, he probably would have won.
There are people that agree with you on that, and I guess I'm one of them. I don't know what that would have made, how much difference. It is telling that the Timor thing wasn't even talked about, but I understand your point of view, I suppose, on what you wanted to do, but the fact that it wasn't even an issue contemporaneously is also telling. As far as post-Watergate, you know, if we'd had a real investigation of what happened, I think the polity would have been much better. So I'm on the side that says that was probably his his greatest mistake. Thanks.
All right. Just to stay just for a moment with Mr. Cheney, one of the things that that you write about in the book is that talking indeed about Mr. Ford and what he thought of Dick Cheney, and that apparently in it was in 2004 he thought that Cheney should have been dropped from the ticket.
Yes, indeed, and this really surprised me because to his dying breath, Jerry Ford loved Dick Cheney. He always thought that Cheney was his prize student. He thought that Cheney and Brent Scowcroft were his two favorite aides, which, of course, is a real irony because Cheney and Rumsfeld have had a colossal falling out over Iraq war policy. But in 2004, Ford said to me that he thought that Cheney should be replaced from the ticket because he had become a liability. And Ford said this to me with the usual indirection that was just classic of Ford. He worked really hard not to say anything bad about anybody, especially people he was very fond of. And he began this conversation. Actually, I began it by saying, "Have you heard from Cheney lately?" It was a very benign reference from me. And he said, "No," but he said, "An interesting thing has happened." He says, "I'm getting a lot of calls from pals in Washington asking me if I think that Cheney should be dumped from the ticket." And he said, "I know why they're calling. They're trying to sound me out to see if I think he's a liability and ought to be dumped. And will I go to Bush and do that?" And he said, "Which I'm not going to do out of affection and loyalty for Dick." And I said, "Well, I got to ask you, do you think he's a liability?" And typical Ford, he said, "Well, I don't think he's been the asset that I had hoped. I prefer to be affirmative." Well, we talked about it a little bit more, and he hemmed and hawed, and finally he admitted that that Cheney had not been an asset in 2004, as he was in 2000. I think that's one of the great ironies of Dick Cheney. I don't think George W. Bush would have been elected in 2000 without Cheney on the ticket, because people were a little nervous about taking a chance on an untested governor of Texas. But the fact that Cheney, who had vast executive and legislative experience, seemed to reassure a lot of people. But by 2004, Cheney's asset had become Cheney a liability.
Our guest in this hour, Tom DeFrank, he's the Washington Bureau Chief of the New York Daily News. He was a correspondent for Newsweek for 25 years. He was a White House correspondent. Then he was also Deputy Chief of the Washington Bureau. And he spent a good number of years covering Gerald Ford, first when he was Vice President, then when he was President. And in 1991, he proposed to Mr. Ford a series of conversations, and indeed they had a number of these conversations over the years. 18 interviews over a 16-year period. The only condition was, or the agreement was between the two men, that they wouldn't be published until after Gerald Ford had gone. And you can read all about this in the recently published book. It's titled "Write It When I'm Gone: Remarkable Off-the-Record Conversations with Gerald R. Ford." It's published by Putnam. Questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. Let's talk with someone next in Champaign in line two. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I was wondering if he ever discussed the meeting he had with the Chief Justice, with Lee Harvey Oswald, at his jail cell shortly before he was murdered. I'll hang up and listen.
No, he did not. I didn't ask him about that. I think this has a reference. This has to do with this silly new book alleging that Gerald Ford believed that there was that Lee Harvey Oswald was part of a conspiracy. I think that's a totally manufactured book. He never said anything like that to me. To the contrary, what he said to me was that he was absolutely certain that there was no conspiracy, that Lee Harvey Oswald acted alone, and he was very firm about that. And he thought that people who promulgated or propounded conspiracy theories were being irresponsible based on the evidence in front of the Warren Commission. He felt very strongly about that. That was the other area, the pardon being the other that we mentioned before, where what he said in private to me was exactly what he said many times in public and in interviews and speeches.
And he was a member of the Warren Commission. At the time that you were talking to him, he was the last surviving member of the Warren Commission.
Exactly, and
he apparently felt very aggrieved if anybody said anything negative about the work of the commission. He apparently felt that they had done a solid job and still stood behind the conclusion, the basic conclusion that Lee Harvey Oswald was the assassin, he worked alone, and that there was no grand conspiracy behind it.
Yes, he always felt that way, and in his conversations with me, he said that all the documents of the Warren Commission should now be declassified and made public. And he said, if that is done, two things will happen. He says, there's a lot of stuff in there that will be embarrassing to politicians because there's a lot of raw data. But he said, it will also make it crystal clear to a reasonable person that Lee Harvey Oswald acted alone. And he thought before his death that the time had come to release all those documents. And I suspect that'll happen in the next few years. I certainly hope so.
Hmm. Let's talk with someone else. The caller here is in Spring Bay. It's line number 4, the toll-free line. Hello.
Yes, good morning. Mm-hmm. I was at the White House the night of October when they were entertaining Gierek from Poland, and they were having some kind of a state dinner or something there. And I've always felt that it was, you know, when Ford said in the debate that he was, that Russia didn't have the full control of Poland, that somehow he might have been thinking in terms of trade talks or whatever were going on with that foreign exchange that night. Did he ever make any comments to you about that comment that he did in the debates? And I'll get off and listen. Thank you.
No, he didn't. But I talked with many of his aides about that, and they all think that Ford got really discombobulated by Jimmy Carter in that debate. That was the second debate in October of 1976 at the Palace of Fine Arts in San Francisco, a wonderful building that survives to this day. And a little earlier in that debate, Jimmy Carter had said something along the lines of, everybody knows that when it comes to foreign policy, Henry Kissinger is the real president of the United States, not Gerald Ford. And Ford just went nuts. Several of his aides said to me at the time, they've said it to me over the years, they said it to me when I went back and talked with them in researching the book, that Ford was so furious about being accused of being a surrogate president, surrogate to Henry Kissinger, that it just so threw him off guard that he made a comment that he had to have known was wrong. As a matter of fact, when Max Frankel of the New York Times did a follow up and gave him a chance to clarify it on the spot, he didn't take the opportunity. He stuck with what he said, that Poland is not dominated by the Soviet Union, and I think it was an imprecise statement. He had to know better. He did know better. I mean, he knew. I think there were 7 Soviet divisions in Poland at the time, at the height of the Cold War, and I just think it totally threw him off.
Well, other questions are welcome from folks that were listening. 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. I'd like to give you the opportunity to talk some about Mr. Ford's feelings about Ronald Reagan. And apparently for a long time, Mr. Ford was angry with Reagan, both because of what happened in 1976, but also because apparently Mr. Ford, he would have liked to have another shot at Jimmy Carter, that obviously didn't happen, and Ford was not happy with Mr. Reagan over that as well.
Right. As I said earlier, I had heard over the years that Ford was still very resentful of Ronald Reagan, though well after Ford had left the White House. It's fairly well known that he never forgave Reagan for running against him in 1976. He thought that a primary challenge made it easier for Jimmy Carter to win. And he also thought, and for Ford this was probably even more unforgivable, that in the general election of 1976, after he defeated Reagan for the Republican nomination, Reagan sat on his hands. He campaigned only in a perfunctory way, didn't campaign in the states where he Reagan was extraordinarily popular. Ford always thought that if Reagan had really worked hard for him in Texas and Mississippi, two states where Reagan was extremely popular, Ford would have won those states and would have won the election, and he really never forgave him for that. But I did not know that he was still angry about Reagan in 1980. Everybody knows that Ford, in the spring of 1980, thought long and hard about jumping into the race and ultimately decided not to. I was in Palm Springs on the Saturday that he came out in front of his office and took himself out, and boy, was he an angry person for at least 48 hours, because he knew that was his last chance to exorcise the title that drove him crazy, accidental president. And he thought that Reagan should have stepped aside for him in 1980 so that he could have a rematch with Jimmy Carter. Ford said to me more than once, I knew I could beat Jimmy Carter. I didn't think Reagan could. Well, he was obviously wrong about that, since Reagan could and did. But he thought that Reagan owed it to him, Ford, to step aside so that Ford could run. Now, that was a totally unrealistic point of view. There was no way Reagan was going to step aside for a guy he'd almost beaten for the nomination in 1976 and who had lost the presidency to the Democrats. But that's the way Ford felt about it. But I should also say, in President Ford's defense, that from the moment the world learned about Reagan's Alzheimer's disease, Jerry Ford never uttered another unkind word about Reagan. Never revisited those unhappy days in 1976 and 1980. For the next 12 years of his life, Jerry Ford just basically said, "I have nothing but compassion and affection and for Ronald and Nancy Reagan." So at that point, he let the bitterness of 1976 and 1980. He put it in another box. He never let it go entirely, but he never talked about it again.
All right, let's talk with someone in Terre Haute, Indiana, line 4. Hello.
Yes, I'd like to ask you the question about Gerald Ford's, what I feel is a debacle about the swine flu vaccine stuff that was killed several people. Did he ever speak to you at all about any regrets to his pushing that program?
Well, no, he did speak about it, but he just said that was the recommendation of his advisors. They knew that it was it might not work, but they thought that he thought he had an obligation to public health to give it a try. And of course, it spent a lot of money. It was in fact a bit of a fiasco. But he didn't second guess himself or his political and medical advisors about it. I mean, Ford was a guy who slept soundly at night. Once he made a decision, he agonized sometimes over decisions, but once he made them, he didn't agonize them. He just kept on. He didn't agonize over them, and he just kept on going. So he didn't. He felt like under the circumstances, he did what he should have done, and it didn't work out the way people thought. But that's the way it happens sometimes.
What was the cost of that?
I have no idea. I'm sure it's easily researchable, but I don't know off the top of my head.
Okay. Yeah, thank you very much.
Thank you. Other questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. We talked a little bit about the way that Mr. Ford thought about Ronald Reagan and that he was angry for a long time about what happened in 76 and in 80. You would expect that perhaps also he would not be real happy with Jimmy Carter because he was the man who defeated him in his bid to be elected in his own right as president. What did Gerald Ford think about Jimmy Carter?
Well, it began as a disastrous relationship. He didn't like him. He couldn't stand him, and he thought that he was deeply embarrassed that he had lost to Jimmy Carter, a man who he thought had zero foreign policy experience. As a matter of fact, after the election, before the inauguration in 1977, Ford would sometimes say to aides, "A peanut farmer. I was beaten by a peanut farmer." So there was deep embarrassment and deep resentment there. But over the course of time, the relationship mellowed. It developed into a real friendship. The friendship, like most friendships, had its ups and downs. over the years, but he always thought Jimmy Carter was one of his best friends, and it was not a coincidence that Jimmy Carter was the eulogist, the principal eulogist in Grand Rapids when Ford's body returned home for its final resting place. It was not a coincidence because former presidents have to put together their funeral plans in life. That's just the kind of the way it works. The military organizes state funerals for former presidents, but the former presidents have to tell the military what they want. Here are my pallbearers. Here are my honorary pallbearers. I want to be buried here. They have to decide whether they're going to lie in state in the East Room of the White House or the Rotunda of the Capitol or no place. So all these things are decided by the deceased in their lifetime. And the bottom line is that Gerald Ford very much wanted Jimmy Carter to deliver that eulogy in Grand Rapids. That was his idea, and I think that tells you something about the friendship between the two.
Yeah. You tell a story about how, in fact, Mr. Ford said to you, he said, Tom, you're invited to the funeral, and I will be very disappointed if you don't show up.
Yeah, what he exactly said, this was about 5 years ago, he said, oh, by the way, he was walking me out the door after an interview in California. He said, oh, by the way, I put you on the guest list for the funeral, and I'm going to be damn sore if you don't attend. And I used a line that I had mentioned to him many times before, and I said, Mr. President, I've been saying for years that you're going to outlive us all, but in the unfortunate event that I'm wrong about that, I'd be honored to attend. And he said, good, because I want you there. And then he changed the subject. And, of course, as I say in the book, as promises go, that was probably one of the easiest I've ever had to keep in my life, to attend his funeral.
Yeah. You, I know that you continued to talk to him over a period of time, and you certainly could see that his health was declining, and I think that you talked to him shortly before he passed away. Given that it sounds like the two of you really built a relationship and became close, that must have been difficult.
Well, the last interview it wasn't even an interview because he was too frail at that point for an interview. I had a really nice interview with him in May of 2006, followed by a wonderful lunch with President Ford and Betty Ford. It was really I call that chapter our last interview and first lunch, because it was the first time we'd ever been to lunch in 32 years together. When I saw him 6 weeks before his death, he had trouble speaking. He was in a hospital bed in the study of his home, same room where we'd had the interview in May, but he had deteriorated to the point that he couldn't sit up in an easy couldn't sit in a chair. He was propped up in a hospital bed in his study, and it was very painful, very personally painful. And they said, can you keep it to 5 minutes? Well, it lasted for 4 minutes, and the reason it lasted for only four is that I don't think either one of us could have handled much more of it. It was very poignant. It was very painful, but it really was. But I will never forget the last words he ever said to me, because they were just so quintessentially Jerry Ford. His last words to me were, come back again. And that was Jerry Ford, kind, decent, thoughtful to the very end, and that's the way I like to remember him. I think we were close, but we weren't close friends. I don't think it makes sense. It's not good for reporters to have real friendships with the people they cover, but certainly we had a very close and warm, I guess is fair, a professional relationship, but I didn't consider him a personal friend. Again, it took me 32 years to finally have lunch with him, but we were professional. We had a very strong professional relationship. He was extraordinarily generous to me for a very long time.
We have about 5 minutes left. Our guest is Thomas DeFrank. He is Washington Bureau Chief of the New York Daily News, wrote for a number of years for Newsweek magazine, and covered Gerald Ford as vice president and president. And his recent book is Write It When I'm Gone, Remarkable Off-the-Record Conversations with Gerald R. Ford. We have a couple of other callers here. We'll see if we can include. Next is someone in Champaign. Line one. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. You say Jerry Ford never said bad things about anybody, but what was his reaction to Lyndon Johnson when Lyndon Johnson said that Jerry Ford couldn't walk and chew gum at the same time?
Well, I didn't say Jerry Ford never said unkind things about anybody. I said that after Reagan got Alzheimer's, for the next 12 years of his life, Jerry Ford never said an unkind word about Ronald Reagan. But he did have strong feelings about a lot of people. He brushed off LBJ's famous put down. Ford was a Yale Law School graduate, just like Bill and Hillary Clinton. So he knew, or he believed, that he was of above average intelligence. So he blew those sorts of things off for the most part. What he didn't like were the notions that came up time and time again when he was president, that he was a kind of an oafish, clumsy stumblebum. That really bothered him, and it really was unfair. Up to a point, it was unfair, because this was a guy who was a very accomplished athlete. He could have been a professional football player had he wanted to be. He was a great skier. I've seen him ski, and until he had to have both knees replaced and the doctor said, no more of this, he was an avid skier. And this was a man who swam laps in a swimming pool twice a day, every day, until he was 90 years old and the doctors made him stop. And so he really resented the notion that he was clumsy. On the other hand, he did have this unfortunate habit of hitting his head on helicopters, and I was there the day in Salzburg in 1975 when he fell down the steps of Air Force One. These things happened, but they were a stereotype that were unfair, and that really resented him. I remember him once saying, you know, the only exercise that these reporters who write these stories about me ever get is when they're bending their elbow at the bar. And for him, that was kind of a remarkable comment, funny and clever, but it also bespoke an irritation about the notion that he couldn't walk and chew gum at the same time.
Let's talk with someone in Tuscola. This is line four. Hello.
Yes, I was curious about... I've done a little historical research with John B. Anderson, did a number of interviews with him, and wrote a large paper that I presented at the Illinois Historical Society. But I find that when the interviewer gets very close to an individual, that sometimes bias comes in. At the same time, another question I might have is that I found that John B. Anderson remembered things that he said through press conferences and repeated frequently, but when other advisors would say something that seemed to effectively all contradicted what he really felt, do you feel like that there's a public persona that seems to persist in their memory and that the real private thoughts are sometimes so deep that you can't really get to them? I'd like to hear your comments on that. Thank you.
Those are very fair comments. The question of bias is always a danger of a reporter getting too close to a source. That's why I wanted this book basically to be conversations with Ford, where Ford was talking. I think if you read this book, you're not going to find a lot of opinion from me. You're going to find a lot of reporting from me and an awful lot of commentary by Gerald Ford about the people and the places and the momentous events in his career. You're not going to see a lot of opinion. I basically wanted to let him talk. And I also would make the other point that I've reinforced the point that I've made earlier, which is history, he doesn't have the last word. History will have another crack at this. Historians will have another crack. And other people who will have been in the room or were privy to Ford will also have a chance to flesh out his observations with their recollections, and sometimes they are very different. I mean, there was another example in the book, I'll make this very quick, that Ford told me that Nelson Rockefeller was fine with the notion of him being dumped from the ticket. Well, that's ridiculous. Rockefeller was furious. Now, he never yelled and screamed at Gerald Ford. He blamed Rumsfeld and Cheney for that, but that's just a fallacious notion, in which I raised with him at the time, but that was his recollection. So recollections do have a tendency to fade, but others will have a chance to embellish, reinforce, and also, if they wish, to contradict some of his recollections.
We have about a minute left. I'm sorry to say that we're going to have to finish up, but just to bring things up to the present, Mr. Ford believed and he told you that he thought Hillary Clinton would be elected president.
No, he didn't.
No, he didn't. He said, oh, I misunderstood.
No. What he said was he thought that Hillary would be the Democratic nominee.
Oh, that she would run for president, not that she would be elected.
Be the Democratic nominee in either 2004 or 2008, and would have a strong chance to be president. But ultimately, he thought that the country wasn't ready for a woman, and that she would not win. That was his bet. But he thought she was tough, strong, tougher than her husband. Had more convictions than her husband, and would be a formidable candidate. But he thought, being an old-fashioned guy, that the country wasn't ready for a woman. And of course, we will see in the next 10 months.
Yeah, the club of former presidents is pretty small. Did often he either offer advice or to the current president, or did presidents seek him out?
Presidents did seek him out, and interestingly enough, Bill Clinton sought him out probably more on policy than any other president. They talked about free trade. They talked about North Korea, and the president sought him out, but he almost never offered advice. He would always point to his phone and say, "Presidents know my phone number, and I know their phone number. And basically, if they need advice, all they have to do is pick up the phone and ask." He says, I don't want to be a professional advice giver. But former presidents talk to one another. You're right, it is a small club. It's what a political operative, a friend of mine, likes to call the White Boys Club, the most exclusive club in America. White Guys Club, she says. So they do talk.
Well, there we'll have to leave it. Our guest, Thomas DeFrank, is the Washington Bureau Chief of the New York Daily News. For many years, worked for Newsweek and covered Gerald Ford as vice president and president. And if you're interested in reading this book that's based on all of these conversations that they had after he had left office, the title of the book is Write It When I'm Gone, Remarkable Off-the-Record Conversations with Gerald R. Ford. It's published by Putnam. Mr. DeFrank, thank you very much.
Thank you very much. I really enjoyed the chat.